This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years of craftsmanship. For a store location near you, you can visit www.peets.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, May 17, 2006. I'm Chris Andre. Election results are in, and it looks like Silent Ted, Kulongoski, and Ron Saxton will go mano a mano in November. Yesterday, it was Bell South. Now today, Verizon says it did not hand the government customers' phone records. And in Iraq, Saddam Hussein and his former intelligence chief will testify on behalf of one of their co-defendants in their trial on crimes against humanity. And we also bring you part three of KBOO correspondent Patrick Engstrom Poor's report from Venezuela. Portland area weather, partly cloudy on the coast, mostly sunny inland, chance of thunderstorms this afternoon, highs in the mid-80s, tonight mostly clear, temperatures in the 50s. Election results are in, and there were few surprises. Low voter turnout was not among them. Ron Saxton chalked up a solid win in the Republican primary and looked ahead to a November contest with Ted Kulongoski, who fended off a spirited Democratic challenge yesterday. Saxton, a Portland lawyer and former school board chairman, portrayed himself as a more conservative candidate than this time around, and he was able to withstand withering attacks by opponent Kevin Mannix, the 2002 Republican primary winner. In what amounted to a referendum on Multnomah County's embattled incumbent chairwoman Diane Lynn, voters overwhelmingly picked a political unknown to lead the state's most populous county. Ted Wheeler, a small business advisor, decisively won his first four-year term by besting the once popular chairwoman by more than a 3-to-1 ratio in incomplete returns. It was the first time in memory that an incumbent Multnomah chair lost the nonpartisan seat that oversees social programs, jails, and care for the elderly and mentally ill. Dan Salzman, the introverted engineer who made children and the environment his trademark issues, earned a third term yesterday on the Portland City Council. But his colleague, Commissioner Eric Sten, may have to wait till November to discover whether he gets another 4 years in City Hall. Salzman defeated neighborhood activist and nurse Amanda Fritz 57% to 23% despite recent turmoil at City Hall and his vote to pump more money into the aerial tram. Portland's regional government got a new auditor yesterday in a spirited race between veteran government watchdogs. Metro auditor Alexis Dow will be replaced by Suzanne Flynn, her counterpart at Multnomah County. Metro's only other new face will come from the west suburbs, where a four-candidate field was narrowed for a runoff in November. Leaders at the regional government, anchored by President David Bragdon, who ran unopposed for a second term, plan the location of homes, jobs, and transportation to keep pace with growth. They also manage regional attractions such as the Oregon Convention Center and the Oregon Zoo. More election coverage. The race for the Multnomah County Commission District 2 position was very close. Jeff Cogan, Chief of Staff for Portland City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, is leading Lou Frederick of the Portland School District by about 5%. Close behind is Gary Hansen. Xander Patterson, a Green candidate, finished a distant fourth. The top two candidates will face a runoff. Multnomah County Sheriff Bernie Giusto maintained his position with a 2-to-1 victory over Don DuPay, who has worked for medical marijuana. And LaVon Griffin Villard defeated Steve March for the job of county auditor. A handful of contested primaries for seats in the Oregon legislature were decided, clearing the way for what's shaping up as a pitched battle for control of the state House and Senate in November. Several of the most closely watched races were in Washington County, where Democratic State Representative Brad Avakian defeated first-time candidate Sam Chase for that seat, formerly held by Democrat Charlie Ringo. Since no Republican challenger has filed for this general election, Avakian will advance immediately to the state Senate with 44% of the votes cast. Avakian had 60%. Also in Washington County, property rights activist Larry George was narrowly beating incumbent state senator Charles Starr in a Republican race that remained too close to call. And over in Multnomah County, in what was billed as a battle of the old versus the new guard, longtime politician Rod Monroe beat political newcomer Jesse Cornett and advisor to Secretary of State Bill Bradbury. Primary contest in the State House of Representatives yielded solid wins for incumbents, including Republican Max Sumner of Molalla and Democrats Diane Rosenbaum and Mitch Greenlick of Portland. Additional House districts in the race for the Democratic candidate for Oregon House District 46, covering parts of southeast and northeast Portland, Ben Cannon won over four opponents. Cannon is on the board of directors of the Oregon Bus Project. The Senate yesterday unanimously confirmed the brother of Oregon Senator Gordon Smith as a federal appeals court judge. Mellon Smith is a Los Angeles business lawyer and a former member of California's Fair Employment and Housing Commission. He'll serve on the San Francisco-based Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In an emotional speech, Gordon Smith said, "It was a special day for me, I know for my brother and all of our family." Smith called his brother exceptionally well prepared, citing credentials from his education at the University of Chicago Law School to his decades as a prominent L.A. area attorney. Mallon Smith also won praise from California's two Democratic senators, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, as well as Republican Senator Orrin Hatch and Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid. The San Francisco-based Ninth Circuit Court covers nine western states with about 54 million people and has 28 judgeships. Oregon businesses took a breather from months of high-paced hiring, adding just 100 workers to their payrolls in April. With seasonal adjustments, the state's non-farm employment stood a little over 17 million workers. State and national economists have been watching for signs of slower economic growth as interest rates have begun to rise and energy prices have spiked. But so far, there's scant evidence that businesses are applying the brakes to a prolonged surge. Oregon employment has been growing since early 2004, when the state finally shook off a three-year recession. Oregon's official economic forecast calls for job growth this year of 2.1%, down from the 2005 rate of 3.1%. Yet, the job tallies so far this year put the state on pace to equal last year's performance, though most of the jobs added were in low-paid service sector positions. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. There are a couple of things to remember when you say Latin America. The term Latin or Latino emphasizes the influence of the conquering Spanish, particularly ignoring the reality of indigenous people who don't identify as Latino. And Mexico is part of North America. And many people south of the U.S. border object to the term American when applied only to people from the United States, because all 880,000 of us are Americans. KBOO's Patrick Angstrom Poor has been traveling through parts of so-called Latin America since October of 2005. For the last several months, he's been living in Petare, one of South America's densest barrios. He brings us a four-part series on life in Venezuela under the leadership of Hugo Chavez's Bolivarian Revolution.
Let's say you're the president of a country with significant wealth and very significant disparity between rich and poor. And let's just say that you've committed yourself to closing this gap. The difficulty is, your wealth is basically just a large supply of a very desirable mineral. Let's say oil. Fortunately, your government has control over oil extraction and production facilities, or this wealth would be flowing right into the pockets of transnational petroleum companies. So what do? You know you can't just give it away. It doesn't really work that way. If you do, when the petroleum gives out, you're just as broke as you were before. This is a good description of the economic situation in Venezuela right now. Economist Arlen Narvaez explains further.
All of Venezuela's oil wealth passes through the state, and the Venezuelan state becomes a great distributor of these benefits. The wealth of a country, however, doesn't depend on its natural resources. The wealth of a country depends on the productive capacity of its population. What generates wealth is not what is sitting up in the tree, but is what's standing on the ground.
Venezuela's government knows it has to figure out a way to turn the hydrocarbon wealth it has into productive capacity. Captain Rommel Rangel is the director of Palmaven, which is part of the Venezuelan state oil company PDVSA, and is in charge of turning oil revenue into sustainable community development projects.
At PDVSA, we, through oil and our culture, form an addiction to petroleum. We have to break this petro-addiction. It's not easy. It's an ideological and cultural job. So we have begun to figure out the places where the oil wealth hasn't really sunk in, so that when the oil revenue arrives, there will already be social development, and the people will continue to participate in these other areas that also generate quality of life.
This is a good time for facts. It's rarely mentioned in U.S. newspapers in a time when our gasoline is quite expensive how much a Venezuelan pays for gas, about 100 bolivares per liter. 2,500 bolivares equals a dollar, so 100 bolivares is about 2 cents. 4 liters in a gallon, actually quite a bit more than a gallon, and we're looking at something like a dime a gallon on a bad day. Basically free. Much, much cheaper than water. Even though most Venezuelans don't have a vehicle, they would definitely be able to afford the gas. Venezuela's ministry says it has the world's largest hydrocarbon reserves if you include natural gas. It's the world's fifth largest exporter of petroleum, and of course, is one of the biggest exporters of petroleum to the U.S. Whatever the rhetoric that you hear in the papers, this is a significant economic relationship. The basic strategy of the Chavez government to divert oil wealth into communities has two parts. First, immediately apply revenue to meet the basic needs of Venezuelans. Sick, hungry, uneducated Venezuelans are not very likely to be able to take the reins of power in their society. The government programs to meet these needs are called missions, recalling Chavez's military origins. These missions are also not very often discussed in the press, but are key in developing a method to promote community development. There are missions to provide work training to those in the informal economy. There is the popular and successful mission to provide basic and secondary education to the majority. There's a mission to provide preventative health care on a very profound level. There was a mission to eliminate illiteracy, but that's been done. And a mission to bring low-cost staple foods into the poorer areas. Once Venezuelans are healthier and better educated, the other side is to stimulate economic development through rigorous support for cooperative formation. Rather than simply investing in small businesses, the Bolivarian government encourages people to form interdependent, productive groups in order to receive resources from the state. These groups might be a business, such as a taxicab co-op, a restaurant, or a small piñata factory. Or it could be a service procurement group, like a drug buying co-op, a neighborhood cleanup crew, or a community radio station. Both the missions and the cooperatives have community organizing elements built in. But to really give it strength, the government has united them into what is called nuclei of grassroots development. The idea is to cluster together cooperatives and missions in a way that makes sense for a given community. So instead of isolated individual government projects, the opportunity exists for mutual support and cross-pollination, and members of the community have a chance to interact with each other more often. Here's a member of a cooperative speaking about the nuclei from a documentary produced by the Venezuelan government.
The nuclei of grassroots development came to be a space of integration, where, for example, the cooperatives and mission Vuelven Caras coexist, where the community can come into contact with its surroundings.
The question really is, at what level can the state use its resources to generate and support true community development? True community development must happen in communities, or it's simply another form of top-down management. In time, we will see whether the missions and the cooperatives can absorb and transcend the support of the Venezuelan state. From Venezuela, I'm Patrick Engstrom Poor.
In San Francisco today, the first court hearing in a lawsuit challenging the Bush administration's domestic spying program opens. A lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court by privacy advocate Electronic Frontier Foundation is accusing AT&T of illegally cooperating with the National Security Agency. The foundation says the phone giant made communications on AT&T networks available to the spy agency without warrants. U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker set today's hearing to determine whether documents brought forward by a former AT&T technician should remain under seal. The government is urging the judge to dismiss the lawsuit because it maintains that it threatens to divulge state secrets and jeopardize national security. The Department of Justice says it secretly sought phone records and other documents last year under a provision of the Patriot Act that does not require judicial oversight. The records were obtained with the use of what are known as national security letters, which can be signed by an FBI agent and are only for use in terrorism cases. The letters require telephone companies to keep secret even the existence of the request for records. Federal law enforcement sources say the national security letters are being used to obtain phone records of reporters at ABC News and elsewhere in an attempt to learn confidential sources who may have provided classified information in violation of the law. The FBI says its request for reporters' phone records are made in compliance with the law. Yesterday it was Bell South, and now today Verizon says that it did not get the government records of millions of phone calls. Vendor dials leave open the possibility that the NSA requested customer calling data from long-distance companies. President Bush still insists that the government does not listen to domestic telephone conversations among ordinary Americans, but he declined to specifically discuss the compiling of phone records or whether that would amount to an invasion of privacy. Bush says he's simply doing his job by protecting Americans from terrorists. Supporters of the immigration legislation established command in the Senate yesterday. They dismissed potentially crippling challenges to a bill that blends tougher border enforcement with a path to citizenship for millions in the United States without documents. On a vote of 55-40 that crossed party lines, the Senate rejected an appeal from GOP Senator Johnny Isaacson to require the border be secured before other immigration law changes could take place. The maneuvering took place at the beginning of what Senate leaders predicted would be a lengthy debate over the most significant changes in immigration law in two decades. Immigration is an election year issue that has laid bare deep divisions inside both parties and sparked street demonstrations across the country. Hundreds of pro-immigrant advocates from at least 20 states were headed to Washington, D.C. to lobby members of Congress today, taking their issue from the streets to the Senate. While reaction to President Bush's address on immigration was mixed, some activists were buoyed by the fact that the issue at least remains a priority. The call to arrange face-to-face meetings with members of Congress and their staffs was put out just a week ago when the We Are America Alliance, a loose coalition of the nation's biggest pro-immigrant groups, was formed. And this is an eye-opener. New federal guidelines ask all females capable of conceiving a baby to treat themselves and to be treated by the healthcare system as pre-pregnant, regardless of whether they plan to get pregnant anytime soon. This from the Washington Post. Among other things, this means all women between first menstrual period and menopause should take folic acid supplements, refrain from smoking, maintain a healthy weight, and keep chronic conditions such as asthma and diabetes under control. While most of these recommendations are well known to women who are pregnant or seek to get pregnant, experts say it's important that women follow this advice throughout their reproductive lives because about half of pregnancies are unplanned and so much damage can be done to a fetus between conception and the time the pregnancy is confirmed. The recommendations aim to increase public awareness of the importance of preconception health and emphasize the importance of managing risk factors prior to pregnancy, said Samuel Posner, co-author of the guidelines and associate director for science in the Division of Reproductive Health at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which issued this report. Seven members of the Congressional Black Caucus were arrested at the embassy of Sudan yesterday while protesting conditions in the nation's Darfur region. The seven were taken away in Secret Service cars after blocking the entrance to the embassy. They were released a short time later after paying $50 fines. Democratic Representative Barbara Lee of California wore a green T-shirt that read, "End the Darfur Genocide." Lee said she visited the Darfur region where, quote, "I saw the desperation in the eyes of the people," unquote. The Sudanese government and main Darfur rebel group signed an agreement on May 5th to end Darfur's three-year civil war, but there have been several attacks since the signing. The U.S. Justice Department has released the first video of the plane crashing into the Pentagon on September 11th. American Airlines Flight 77 slammed into the U.S. military headquarters, killing 184 people after it was hijacked as part of the Al-Qaeda plot. The release of the video, taken from a Pentagon security camera, comes after a Freedom of Information Act request by legal watchdog Judicial Watch. The group said it hoped to dispel conspiracy theories about the crash. Some theorists have suggested the aircraft was shot down in flight and that the Pentagon was struck by a missile. This according to the BBC. Congressional investigators are saying the government won't be ready for another major disaster such as Hurricane Katrina unless the Pentagon takes a more aggressive role in the federal response. The Government Accountability Office urged the Defense Department to establish procedures to speed aircraft, troops, and reconnaissance gear to hurricane-struck areas when local and state officials are overwhelmed, as well as beef up communications support to Homeland Security officials who have the lead role in a disaster. And government prosecutors rewrote Enron history and bullied witnesses into backing their case against its former bosses, their defense team has argued. The claims came on the second day of closing arguments in the case against former Enron bosses Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling. They're accused of trying to hide $32 billion of debt at the firm, but deny any wrongdoing. The jury in Houston, Texas, is expected to begin deliberations today. Energy giant Enron collapsed in 2001 when the massive debts were revealed. Thousands of people lost their jobs and investments. Lay and Skilling both say the other staff were to blame and that they were kept in the dark. Just 2 weeks after the House passed a reform bill requiring lawmakers to attach their names to pet projects, GOP leaders are advancing spending bills containing billions of dollars in such parochial earmarks whose sponsors remain anonymous. So why isn't the Appropriations Committee instituting reforms aimed at introducing greater openness to the earmarking process in the wake of scandals such as Enron and ongoing federal investigations into lawmakers and their earmarks? The official reason is that the disclosure bill isn't yet law and leadership has agreed to apply the disclosure requirements to other committees and not just the Lewis-led Appropriations Committee. Appropriations complain that lawmakers on other committees, like the tax writing Ways and Means, should have to claim responsibility for their part, which is often far more costly. Want an example of anonymous earmark money? Kentucky lawmakers managed to include funding to protect Kentucky bingo parlors from terrorists in a recent defense spending bill. And we have an update on the election results. It appears now that Eric Sten has over 50% of the vote for commissioner, position number two in the city of Portland. So that's a revision of what we previously reported. The results are not formalized as yet. A diplomat from the United Arab Emirates has been kidnapped in Baghdad. Iraqi officials say the unidentified diplomat was abducted by gunmen in the city's Mansour district late yesterday. The UAE diplomat was seized by the gunmen during a visit to his embassy's cultural annex. Mansour is in central Baghdad, just outside the heavily protected green zone where the U.S.-led coalition and Iraqi government have their offices. The UAE's foreign ministry said contact had been lost with one of its Baghdad-based diplomats and that he was believed to have been kidnapped. Saddam Hussein and his former intelligence chief can testify on behalf of their co-defendants in their trial on charges of crimes against humanity. It was not clear when Saddam and Barzan Ibrahim would take the stand. At the beginning of the session, Chief Judge Rauf Abdelrahman had refused defendant Tahar Yassin Ramadan's request that Saddam and Ibrahim be allowed to testify on his behalf. Once a member of Saddam's inner ruling circle, Ramadan is accused of helping direct a crackdown in the town of Dujail and organizing the raising of farmlands there. Ramadan stood and complained that he had no other witness to call to back his contention that he was not in Dujail when Saddam's security forces launched the crackdown in 1982. The prosecution alleges that Saddam ordered Ramadan to bring his forces from the People's Army, a Ba'ath Party militia, to Dujail to participate in the arrests of residents and oversee the raising of farmlands after an assassination attempt against Saddam in that town. In Nigeria, the Senate has rejected a proposed constitutional amendment yesterday that could have allowed Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo a third term. The proposal has widened regional ethnic and religious rifts in Africa's most populous nation, this according to The Guardian. The proposed amendment needed to pass by a two-thirds margin in Nigeria's federal and regional parliaments. Yesterday's floor vote in the capital Abuja appeared to cripple the drive by Obasanjo's supporters. Obasanjo has not said publicly whether he would run for a third term, but has indicated he would like to see through the reforms he implemented after his election in 1999 cemented. After his election in 1999 cemented the end of brutal military rule in that country. The UN Security Council has voted unanimously to start the process which could lead to a UN peacekeeping force in Sudan's war-torn Darfur region. The UN force would eventually take over from African Union peacekeepers, although Sudan opposes that move. A joint United Nations AU assessment mission should now be sent to Darfur within a week. The resolution also threatens strong and effective measures against any individual or group that blocks the Darfur peace agreement. Some 2 million people have fled their homes during the 3-year conflict, which the U.S. says is a genocide against Darfur's African population. Russia and China have blocked previous attempts to put pressure on Sudan at the UN. Both have strong trade links with the country. The European Central Bank warned last night of dangers to the world economy by a plunge in the dollar as the U.S. currency came under renewed pressure on foreign exchange markets. Christian Neuer, a member of the ECB's governing council, said a marked appreciation in the greenback would be bad for growth in the 12-nation eurozone and run counter to agreements made by the G7 industrial nations. Neuer's remarks came as a business survey in Germany showed that a stronger euro and higher commodity prices may already be hurting confidence. While foreign exchange dealers remain confident that the ECB will raise rates by at least a quarter point next month, the U.S. figures prompted speculation that the Federal Reserve will pull back from raising borrowing costs for a 17th successive time at its June meeting. Venezuela's defense minister said yesterday that there are no immediate plans to sell U.S.-made fighter jets, despite a dispute over replacement parts, backing away from one general statement that the planes could go to Iran. Defense Minister Admiral Orlando Mangiela said a sale of the 21 F-16s wasn't in the works, and President Hugo Chavez has not given any orders to what to do with the aircraft. General Alberto Mueller, an advisor to Chavez, said earlier he had recommended to the Defense Ministry that Venezuela consider selling its F-16s after the U.S. announced a ban on arms sales to the South American country. A leaked report in Australia detailed horrific levels of sexual abuse in remote Aboriginal communities, including the rape of a baby. A state prosecutor in the Northern Territory has alleged that violence against women and children has become entrenched in many areas. Many crimes go unreported, with victims afraid to speak out. The state's government says it will urgently address the lack of adequate policing in remote Aboriginal camps. This according to the BBC. And this has been the KBOO Morning News for Wednesday, May 17th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Boone Revis is engineering for us this morning. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. And I'm Chris Andre. Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on translator K264AA. 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO evening news at 5 p.m. Portland area weather today, partly cloudy on the coast, mostly sunny inland, chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs in the mid-80s, tonight mostly clear, temperatures in the 50s. Stay with us. Coming right up at 7:30, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. The topics will be the results of today's elections and the Bush immigration plan. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller speaks with Catherine Albrecht, author of the award-winning Spy Chips, How Major Corporations and Government Plan to Track Your Every Move with RFID, about advances in implementation of radio frequency identification technology at the consumer level. That's your level. At 10:30, Andrew will interview Dr. Azam Alwash, director of the Eden Again Project, which works to restore the marshlands of southern Iraq and Iran. And Jay Thiemeyer will review the work of Portland's Aurora Chorus, a group of powerful women singing peace. And be sure to stay with us at 11. It's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Tonight on the KBOO Evening News at 5 o'clock, part 3 of the ongoing series about the upcoming Trojan implosion. KBOO reporter Doug Greedy explores the resurgence of nuclear power in the wake of global climate change. He speaks with Physician for Social Responsibility Executive Director Catherine Thomason. In case you missed the news, Trojan Nuclear Plant is owned by Enron, and they're blowing it up this Sunday morning at 7 a.m. That's tonight on the KBOO Evening News at 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening.